In September 2021, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Likewise, a spate of successful hacking attacks, which have broken into the servers of major Israeli companies, further exposed the weakness of the regime's intelligence service. But resistance against Israel is not restricted to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank alone. Other resistance groups, such as Lebanon's Hezbollah, have dealt severe blows to the regime in response to its acts of aggression. The multifaceted attacks against Israel have devastated the regime's illusion of invincibility and its dreams of ruling from the Nile to the Euphrates.
The 16th session of the Quds Conference for Palestinian Youth was held in Damascus. Participants discussed means of uniting Palestinians in service of their cause, hailing resistance operations in occupied Palestine and the people's uprising in the face of Israeli forces.
Our message in this conference is that Palestinian youth outside Palestine are present on the front lines, just like the youth in Quds, Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians are uniting. This Sword of Palestine battle reflects this unity, and this conference is one of the results of that battle.
The conference is held in parallel with the International Al-Quds Day, which was set by late Imam Khomeini on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan every year.
The message of Iran on Quds Day is that the only path for regaining Palestinian rights is resistance against the crimes of the Zionist entity. The message of Quds International Day is Islamic unity in the face of Israeli crimes. The track of normalization will not affect regaining Palestinians' rights.
We as Palestinians, Syrian and Arab youth send a message to our people in Quds in Aqsa Mosque that we will support them until the liberation of Palestine, from the sea to the river. Thanks to the Resistance Alliance, today we are more capable of triumphing. And as Imam Khamenei said, Quds will remain the axis.
The final communique called for national unity among all Palestinian factions, as well as re-establishing the PLO with a national plan based on resistance against the Israeli enemy. Events like this reiterate that Palestinian refugees across the world will never give up their right of repatriation. It's a message to Israel that their struggle will never stop until ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
In the limelight.
For the last two decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world to help conduct its global war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Nick Terse, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Global Drone War Has Killed Untold Numbers of Civilians, Including Children. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Madhuba's Musa Abdullah still remembers the phone call, but what came next was a blur. He drove for hours deep into the Libyan desert, speeding toward the border with Algeria. His mind buckled, his thoughts reeled, and more than 3 years later, he is still not certain how he made that six-hour journey. The call was about his younger brother, Nasser, who, as he told reporters, was more than a sibling to him. He was also a close friend. Nasser was polite and caring. He loved music, sang, and played the guitar. Abdullah finally found Nasser near the village of Al-Ayanat. Or rather, he found all that remained of him. Nasser and 10 others from their village of Obari had been riding in 3 SUVs that were now burnt-out hunks of metal. The 11 men had been incinerated. Abdullah knew one of those charred corpses was his brother, but he was at a loss to identify which one. If these bodies had recently been found strewn about in the village of Bucha or other places outside a train station in Kramatorsk or elsewhere, the images would have been splashed across the internet, earning worldwide attention and prompting fierce and justified outrage. Instead, the day after the attack, November 29, 2018, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, issued a press release that was met with almost universal silence. Earlier this month, Abdullah, along with a spokesperson for his ethnic Tuareg community and representatives of 3 non-governmental organizations, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, Italy's Red Italiana, PACE, DO, Disarmo, and Reprieve, a human rights advocacy group, filed a criminal complaint against Colonel Cirati, the former Italian commander at the U.S. Air Base in Sinola, Italy, from which that American drone took off. They were seeking accountability for his role in the killing of Nasser and those other 10 men. The complaint requested that the public prosecutor's office in Siracusa, where the base is located, prosecute Colonel Cirati and other Italian officials involved in that airstrike for the crime of murder. The drone attack of November 29, 2018, where 11 innocent people lost their lives in Libya, is part of the broader U.S. program of extrajudicial killings. This program is based on a notion of preemptive self-defense that does not meet the canons of international law, as the use of lethal attacks of this nature is only legitimate where the state is acting to defend itself against an imminent threat to life. In this circumstance, the victims posed no threats, reads the criminal complaint. In light of this premise, the drone attack on Al-Ayanat on November 29, 2018, stands in frontal contrast to the discipline, Italian and international, regarding the use of lethal force in the context of law enforcement operations. For the last 2 decades, the United States has been conducting an undeclared war across much of the globe, employing proxy forces from Africa to Asia, deploying commandos from the Philippines to the West African nation of Burkina Faso, and conducting airstrikes not only in Libya but in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Over those years, the U.S. military has taken pains to normalize the use of drone warfare outside established war zones while relying on allies around the world, as that Italian base in Siracusa, to help conduct its global war. Clearly, a drone operation employing lethal force is not routine, said Meloni, legal advisor at European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, adding, while AFRICOM is directly responsible, the Italian commander must have known about and approved the operation and can therefore be criminally responsible as an accomplice for having allowed the unlawful lethal attack. That November 2018 drone attack in Libya was anything but a one-off strike. During just 6 months in 2011 alone, U.S. MQ-1 Predator drones flying from Sinola conducted 241 airstrikes in Libya during Operation unified protector, the NATO air campaign against then-Libyan autocrat Muammar Gaddafi, according to retired Lieutenant Colonel Gary Peppers, the former commander of the 324th Expeditionary Reconnaissance Squadron. The unit was responsible, he told The Intercept in 2018, for over 20% of the total of all Hellfire missiles expended in 14 years of the system's deployment. The U.S. air war in Libya accelerated in 2016 with Operation Odyssey Lightning. That summer, the Libyan government of National Accord requested American help in dislodging Daesh from Sirte. The Obama administration designated the city an area of active hostilities, loosening guidelines designed to prevent civilian casualties. Between August and December of that year, according to an African press release, the U.S. carried out in Sirte alone 495 precision airstrikes against vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, heavy guns, tanks, command and control centers, and fighting positions. Those military strikes were nothing new. The United States has been conducting attacks in Libya since before there even was a Libya, and almost a United States. In his first address to Congress in 1801, President Thomas Jefferson spoke of coastal kingdoms in North Africa, including the least considerable of Barbary states, Tripoli, now the capital of modern Libya. His refusal to pay additional tribute to the rulers of those kingdoms in order to stop their state-sponsored privateers from seizing American sailors and cargo kicked off the Barbary Wars. In 1804, Lieutenant Stephen Decatur led a daring nighttime mission, boarding a captured U.S. ship, killing its Tripolitan defenders and destroying it. And an attack the next year by 9 Marines and a host of Allied mercenaries on the North African city of Derna ensured that the shores of Tripoli would have prime placement in the Marine Corps hive.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is related to the month of Ramadan. As you know, we're in the month of Ramadan. We're approaching the last days of Ramadan. And we really hope that all of us, including our listeners, have been able to benefit from this most spiritually opportune month. As you know, the month of Ramadan is a month in which fasting is made obligatory upon all Muslims. It's also one of the, this is a part of Ramadan. Also, one other part of Ramadan is, the fact that the Quran was revealed in Ramadan. So there's a lot of virtues and, you know, distinctions for this most blessed month. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking this question. What happens if somebody breaks his fast? What happens if somebody loses control of himself and without an excuse breaks his fast and cannot control himself and eats something or does something else which invalidates his fast? What would be the result of this spiritually? Of course, you know that breaking one's fast, voluntarily and knowing the consequences of it, knowing the fact that it's obligatory, and it has certain repercussions. It has a fine and has a penalty, which has been demarcated within Islamic jurisprudence, and we don't want to get into that discussion right now. We have other programs here at IRB Radio in which such laws have been discussed and have been elaborated. Right now we're going to look at kind of the spiritual consequences of breaking one's fast. And fortunately, we have a answer to this in some ahadith which have been narrated from the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt and the family of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. In a beautiful tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has been narrated to have said, "Man aftara yawman min shahr Ramadan, kharaja ruh al-iman minhu." If somebody breaks his fast, even one day in the month of Ramadan, the spirit of faith exits him. This beautiful tradition has been narrated in the famous collection and compendium of ahadith and traditions, Wasail al-Shia, volume 7, page 181. It is the fourth and fifth hadith in that book, as well as in Man la yahdhuruhu al-faqih, volume 2, page 73. Right, so based upon this blessed tradition and hadith, we see that breaking one's fast in the month of Ramadan, knowingly and without an excuse, right, it's so grave and it's such a severe sin that it leads, not only does it have a spiritual effect on the lower levels of our soul, but it has an effect on our faith, meaning so our this action that we perform, which is a bodily action, which is a physical action, right, such as putting food in one's mouth, this is so profound and so severe that it leads to the destruction of our iman, the destruction of our faith, and it causes the spirit of faith which was in us to exit us, right? So for this reason, we would request our esteemed listeners to please have self-control and, protect one's fast and avoid performing acts which would lead to the invalidation of their fasting in this month. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the effects of breaking one's fast in the month of Ramadan. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
Lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Israeli crackdowns on Palestinians are nothing new, but this time it was the Holy Mosque of Al-Aqsa that was desecrated in the attacks. Thousands across the globe demonstrated in solidarity with the Palestinians. Pro-Palestine rallies are nothing new in Iran, but this year, after 2 years of cancellations due to COVID-19, the annual Quds Day turnout was a matter of excited anticipation. International Quds Day is the last Friday of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, on which rallies are held to keep alive the notion of resistance till the freedom of Palestine from the clutches of Zionist usurpers. Originally introduced by Iran, this year the day falls to April the 29th. The plight of Palestine and how it all started is no secret to the world any longer. It had nothing to do with Arabs selling their land off to European non-Semitic Jews. And even if it partially did, the notion is putting the cart before the horse, because the whole thing was part of an old conspiracy to find European Jews a land of their own, which would also serve as a Western base in the Middle East. Just look at Israel participating in Eurovision contests. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. It was towards the end of the 19th century that the creation of the Zionist movement resulted in many European Jews immigrating to Palestine, if you like. Jewish land purchase began as early as the 1880s until the establishment of what's largely recognized as the State of Israel in 1948. But even by 1944, Jews had acquired only 6% of the land in Palestine, although that's besides the point, as private land ownership doesn't warrant owning the country you own land in. Anyway, all is known, but that hasn't made things any better for Palestinians. Now, that could be put down to several factors: an increase in the US's unjust support for Israel, with Saudi facilitating the US policy, some other Arab states openly giving the handshake to Israel, and a United Nations personalized to world powers with a right to veto. Dr. Shakibai is deputy head of the Population for Support of the Palestinian People. We met him at the Media Cultural Center in a leafy area of North Tehran, veering east.
In fact, the support given to Israel by the U.S. government is different from the support given by some Arab countries. I mean, you cannot say that both of these two groups enjoy an authority in this game. The U.S.'s support can be rooted in many different things, while countries such as the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, which have taken measures to normalize ties with Israel, is rooted in their desperation. The reason is that these countries are worried that they are going to lose the support of a big power called America, because the U.S. has announced that it is going to withdraw from the region. Now, all these years, these desperate countries, which have always relied on a foreign power to keep their system of government in place, are seeking an alternative power to rely on.
Palestinians have, of course, had to defend their rights and lives before a power-backed usurping force. And if that's the actual cause of it, Israel decided to close its only crossing for Palestinian workers coming from the Gaza Strip. The move has been denounced as collective punishment of the impoverished territory's 2 million residents who have lived under an Israeli-Egyptian blockade for almost 15 years. Dr. Ashna is a Palestinian affairs analyst who visited us at Press TV studios.
It is needless to say that every now and then we hear in the news that one or two Palestinians have been killed or injured by Israeli soldiers. It doesn't surprise anyone anymore. But why does this killing and this conflict not end? It is because Palestinians have lost their lands to some bullies. The land of the Palestinians has been usurped and they have been deprived of their political and civil rights. This is the main story, which includes all the killings and the demolition of houses. Israel has usurped their homeland and expelled them from their country. Palestine's population is 14 million. 50% of this population has been displaced.
The move to close the Gaza Strip was announced on Saturday, April the 23rd, after the Israeli army accused Hamas, the group ruling the Gaza Strip, of firing 3 rockets into Israel Friday. As tensions have been mounting in Ramadan, with the Muslim holy month coinciding with Jewish Passover, giving Jews an excuse to enter Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is forbidden for prayer to non-Muslims. The past few years have been an era of provocation, as former US President Trump simply cherry-picked Jerusalem out of the Palestinians' garden as the new capital of Israel. That was in 2017, the year of his election. But apparently it wasn't enough to provoke all regional Muslim states. By 2020, 5 Arab League countries had established diplomatic relations with Israel. Dr. Abu Sharif is representative of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad to Iran. In interviewing him, I realized I understand more Arabic than I realized.
Because the Western world or the world itself in general is conspiring with the Zionist entity completely. The states that created the Zionist entity in our region are Britain, France and other European states, because the creation of it was a Western project in principle. So how are you going to ask the above-mentioned European states to deal with this problem? Later, the U.S. government took the responsibility of supporting the Zionist entity with all its means and tools, so today, American policies in the region are supporting this entity. The U.S. imposed its policies upon the world in the past, while today is pushing some regional states to normalize their relations with Israel through its policy of carrot and stick. Unfortunately, with the existence of this world order, there is absolutely no chance to achieve any progress in this regard. Human rights organizations are working very hard while their reports are being sent to the UN, but all in vain.
The six Arab states defected and defecting, so to speak, were Egypt, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Jordan, and Morocco. Saudi Arabia didn't have to, as its very existence is owed to secret deals consenting to the birth of Israel. Saudi Arabia having been founded as late as 1932 as one of the regional artificially produced states. As for Egypt, like Jordan, it already had full diplomatic relations with Israel. That was since the signing of peace treaties in 1979 and 1994.
Since more than 22 years ago, all polls have been asserting that the Arab and Muslim stance has not changed. Their positions have been very clear. More than 88% of Arab nation are refusing any kind of relationships with the Zionist entity. This is the real and authentic position of the Arab nation. These dictatorial regimes are lacking any popular support. They have been imposed upon their people by force while depending on aliens for their survival. For this reason, they do not depend on their people's allegiance and loyalty.
The UN General Assembly Resolution 3379 of the year 1975 did determine that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination, but it was strongly opposed by US officials. In 1991, the General Assembly effectively negated Resolution 3379 by adopting Resolution 4686. In 1991, I said, the year since which the United States has been the world's dominant military, economic, social, and political power, not to mention hosting the UN headquarters itself in New York City. Call it a coincidence, but the United Nations has been a factory of failures since. After all, it was not designed for the unipolar world we were left with after the fall of the Soviet Union.
I think at the moment the only obstacle that prevents the Palestinians from achieving their right is the oppressive veto power that has been given to five countries at the United Nations. This discrimination and oppression is not limited to the Palestinian nation only. Any country which acts against the benefits of these five countries will be harassed through this veto power. Palestinians are fortunately subject to these oppressions. And any resolution passed in the UN which is against the benefits of Israel is vetoed in the Security Council, hence stopped.
Thus far, there have been plenty of resolutions against Israeli atrocities and illegal settlements on Palestinian land, but they've been all too easy to veto. By May 2021, the United States had vetoed dozens of such United Nations Security Council resolutions, including at least 53 since 1972. That's according to UN data. With an escalation of violence between Israel and the Palestinians, the US stuck by that trend. And in late May of last year, Washington blocked a joint statement calling for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. That would reportedly be the US's third such veto within a week.
Yes, of course, these regional projects did affect the Islamic Ummah. For instance, the big Arab revolution in the Arabian Peninsula, they were obliged to cooperate with superpowers at that time, such as Britain. For this reason, there was a relation between Sharif Hussein and the British. The Saudis project cooperated with the British, as well as later with the Americans, in order to consolidate their positions in the region. All these partial projects were like this. The kings of the sects in an ancient historical story, even in Andalusia, in order to consolidate any individual's position, he got to cooperate with the Ummah's enemies, not friends. Today, the history repeats itself. In order to install a new king, he must obtain the American administration's consent. So the most important consent could be obtained from the Americans would be the recognition of Israel and normalizing the relations with it.
The U.S. may have bullied and bribed the cousins into turning their backs on Palestine, but to Iran, an atypically non-Semitic, that is to say non-Arab state in the region, standing up for Palestine is both a matter of pride and national security. Iranians both sympathize and realize the depth of the Israeli dream. The Israeli dream being beginning with Palestine only to end up occupying from the Nile to the Euphrates.
Firstly, Iran deals with the Palestinians based on the fact that Palestine belongs to them and is their undisputable right, and that there is no whatsoever right for the Zionists, who must be punished for their crimes over the past years. Imam Khomeini dubbed this Zionist entity as a cancerous tumor planted at the heart of the Islamic Ummah by force, so it must be removed. This is the official stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran. All its policies are being based on this idea. Of course, there are many aids given to the Palestinians from political, morale, material, and military aspects, but the Islamic Republic of Iran has been the only side that never stopped its support to the resistance in Palestine.
And so Quds Day, declared in 1979, was embraced by the Islamic world and nations, seeing the loss of Palestinian rights as an undeniable fact. Importantly, eventually, the Iranian resistance movement and Shia factions in South Lebanon further joined forces with the Palestinian resistance organizations. Now, this collective resistance may lose powerful figures such as Iran Soleimani or Iraq's al-Muhandis, but the movement is a crawling but living juggernaut.
Israeli regime knows well that if it wasn't for Iran's support, the resistance in Palestine wouldn't last long. The Israelis believe that removing Iran means beheading the resistance movement. Israel's acts of sabotage, enmity and animosity towards Iran are all because Iran, when it comes to the issue of Palestine, respects values that have unfortunately lost their attractiveness for some Arab countries. These values are so significant for Iran that it is ready to pay its costs. But it is sad to say that the Arab normalizers of ties with Israel pay attention only to the benefits they can gain from the Israel-Palestine conflict.
For a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Which began and what is are facts in hand. But the future also seems to be coming to the fore, with extreme measures speeding up historical change. Question is Israel overdoing it and moving towards self-destruction given the resistance movement continues to stand firm? Voices broadcast out of Israel have sounded desperate as of late. But the fact on the ground remains, Israeli and Palestinian estimates indicate there are about 650,000 settlers living in 164 settlements and 116 outposts in the West Bank, including in occupied Jerusalem, according to AA.
No, of course, in light of the current international equation that formed the Zionist entity and still depends on it as an advanced base, it's not possible to find a solution, whatever solution could be. We saw Oslo agreements in the year 1993 and their outcomes after 30 years. Of course, there haven't been any results except a big decline on the ground. For instance, there have been more and more settlements and confiscations of lands. For all these reasons, there is no hope of a political solution. The only horizon in front of us is resistance, which is the feasible solution. At the end of the day, the Zionist entity does not have roots in this region and no extension.
Looking at the international law, Iran's solution for the Israel-Palestine conflict is very fair and reasonable. But the realities in the international arena and in the region have created a condition that makes it seem impossible to achieve. But this is not true. The solution suggested by Iran is an ideal which can be fulfilled through long-term planning. The Islamic Republic of Iran says that the Palestinians, who are the real owners of this land but have been expelled from their own country, should return, and those who do not belong to this land but have usurped it must leave, and then the Palestinian nationals, Christians, Muslims and Jews, decide for their own destiny via referendum. They should make decision about the type of government they want in their country. This is the most democratic plan.
What would be favorable results of resistance to the present crisis ought to be the choice of the Palestinians. In 2020, Iran came up with a logical proposal that Palestinians be allowed internationally to hold a referendum to decide the fate of the occupied lands. That would mean a vote by all original and historical inhabitants of the occupied territories, both those who are still there and those who have been displaced. This would include Muslims, Christians, and Jews and their descendants, all original Palestinians. Iran even presented its initiative entitled National Referendum in Palestine to the United Nations. Plenty more to come, but first a quick media break to see what other outlets have to say on the matter. Looking at other outlets, it seems Palestine has potential for more than just the news. Tehran Times reads, IRIB welcomes Quds Day by screening films on Palestine. IRIB, or the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, will be showing 7 movies on the Namoyesh Network, an IRIB channel for screening films, in a week-long program. The beginning film is Naghi al-Ali by Egyptian filmmaker Atif el-Tayyib, about Palestinian cartoonist Naghi al-Ali, who was assassinated in London in 1987. He was noted for his political criticism of the Arab regimes and Israel in his works. Iranian director Habib Kavosh's 1990 drama Hidden Fire has also been chosen to be screened. Another film in the program is The Buried Secret by Iranian director Ali Ghaffari. The film is about Amir Kalakish, also known as Abu Zainab, a resistance fighter who died during an operation against an Israeli convoy in 1985. His operation killed 12 troopers in the Israeli occupation forces and wounded 14 others. Iranian director Jamal Shurjeh's 33 Days, a film on the Israeli 33-day war of 2006 against Lebanon, will also be screened. Iranian director Parviz Sheikhzadeh's 2009 anti-Zionist drama Saturday's Hunter is a highlight of the program. The film is about a boy and his grandfather who execute Arab civilians in order to steal their land. Now, Quds Day is all about supporting the Palestinian cause, and Tasnim News runs the headline, Iran urges Muslim world strong message in support of Palestine. The foreign minister of Iran expressed hope that Muslim governments, parliaments and nations would throw their weight behind the Palestinian people and condemn the Zionist regime's atrocities ahead of the International Quds Day. The top Iranian diplomat, Amir Abdullahian, strongly condemned the desecration of the holy site of Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Zionist regime, saying, "We witness crimes at the hands of Zionists on a daily basis at Al-Aqsa Mosque." Now it's from film to cartoon. IGNA reads, call for International Cartoon Festival of Al-Quds announced. The festival will be held with 2 focus topics of normalization, betrayal, and misery of Nakba Day. The efforts to normalize relations between some Arab and Islamic countries with the Israeli regime and the closeness of Nakba Day with this year's Quds Day have been named as the reason for choosing these themes. June the 21st has been announced as the deadline for sending cartoons. The top winner will receive an honorary diploma plus €1,500. The event is organized by ABNA News Agency in collaboration with the Committee for the Support of the Islamic Revolution of the Palestinian People, Center for Strategic Studies of Shahid Fazil, Iraq, that is, Islamic Relief Center of Bahrain, Artistic District of the Islamic Revolution, that's Iran, and Comprehensive Website of Islamic Art. That'll be it for the news section. Iran, a regional superpower and supporter of Palestinian rights and Muslim pride, is a nuisance to Israel. So what's amounted to Iran's regional influence today and a JCPOA it might have revived with the Vienna talks have been cause for serious concern to Israel. It was during the Vienna JCPOA talks that Israel, without a shadow of a doubt, sabotaged Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, among other acts of hostility. The question arises, how effective has the reaction and strategy of a Palestinian and Islamic resistance been?
The Palestinians' strategy of resistance have so far proved to be fruitful because they have made many achievements through this resistance, such as freeing part of their occupied territories, creating a condition of balanced power with Israel, and proving to the world that a nation called Palestine exists on this earth. If it were not for their sacrifices, today we would have not had Palestine anymore. Above all, they have been able to establish a government. In the past, Israel used to do military operations anywhere safely. But today, before jumping into action, it assesses all the aspects of any operation because it is worried about the reaction of Palestinians.
To stop annexation by now right-wing run Israel is going to take a lot more than suggestion. Talking of annexation, here's an instance Netanyahu maneuvered on. Annexation of the Jordan Valley was first proposed in the 1967 Alon Plan. But later, in September 2019, it was announced by the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as his plan, subject to the outcome of the September 2019 Israeli legislative election. Looking at the desperate situation of dead ends wherever Palestinians turn to, it's no wonder Quds Day is respite. Today, Jerusalem, as Trump's preferred capital of Israel, and the Jordan Valley are not the only sore spots with the people of the region and Muslim world. The United States recognized the Golan Heights as part of Israel through a presidential proclamation signed by Donald Trump on March 25, 2019. This made the United States the first country to recognize Israeli rather than Syrian sovereignty over the Golan Heights region. In 2020, the U.S. actually embarrassed itself with proposing the notorious bound-to-fail deal of the century, what Iran calls treason of the century. This Trump or Kushner plan was officially titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. It claimed to be the road to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or Israeli-imposed conflict with Palestine. Practically, the plan would have given Palestinians comfort for their country.
It's no wonder any Palestinians that might have considered a two-state solution still boycotted Trump's peace plan and so had him scrap U.S. funding to pressure them into allowing Israeli expansionism. Now, using the word expansionism in relation to Israel goes to show that entity is truly a modern-day invading force that has no business taking from or sharing with Palestinians. And any West Asian accepting the notion is doing so either to take what he can or only out of sympathy with what's now fourth-generation Israelis.
Since the 2021 U.S. elections, eyes have been turned to current U.S. President Joe Biden and his role in the peace process or no process. But Israeli right-wing parties, which dominate the political arena, reject the two-state solution and call for the annexation of about a third of the West Bank. Recently, they have really moved up close to the West Bank. Even in those days when corona was rampaging, there was no respite, even for Palestinian kids behind bars with no charge. By Quds Day 2021, there were no less than 4,500 Palestinians in Israeli jails. Of the thousands behind bars, 430 were administrative detainees held without charge or trial, including 180 children and 41 women and girls. There were 550 prisoners suffering from various illnesses, including 11 with cancer and 7 with kidney failure and heart disease.
That'll be it for today, although Quds lives on to receive a lot more coverage. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Thanks from the whole team. Bye for now.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
Iran has hosted an iftar dinner in support of Palestine amid a rise in Israel's violence against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran. Let's check it out.
Turn the pot over to let the tasty maqluba slip into the dish. Maqluba is a Palestinian upside-down rice, usually cooked with chicken or lamb. Now, these Iranian and Lebanese women have taken part in a group cooking of maqluba as a solidarity gesture with Palestinian women amid the escalation of the Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. They say maqluba is not just a delicious food, but a symbol of the downfall of Israel.
Maqluba is indigenous to the Levant area, such as Lebanon, Syria, and especially Palestine. The last stage of the food's recipe is to run over the pot that contains the food. Today, it has become a symbol of victory for Al-Quds and a defeat for Israel.
Turning over the pot symbolizes the downfall of Israel. Interestingly, Israel has imposed a ban on the entry of pots into Al-Aqsa Mosque since they have come to learn about what it means to turn over the maqluba pots.
Since the start of the month of Ramadan, Israeli forces have been assaulting Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, injuring scores of people. The escalation in tensions has drawn worldwide condemnation, with protesters calling on the UN to take action to end the regime's crackdown against Palestinians.
Palestine is for Palestinians. Israel has been repeating its barbaric behavior towards Palestinians since 7 decades ago, and today it has taken its violence to another level by doubling down on its use of force. I think they are angered by Palestinians' resistance, and that's why they have resorted to violence.
This humanitarian move is one of tens of solidarity gestures staged in Iran and worldwide in support of Palestinians. The event also comes ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan.
Enjoy the maqluba and wish Palestinians good luck in their struggle against occupation. Chefs here say, aside from symbolizing the victory of Al-Quds against occupation, this event seeks to raise awareness of the Palestinian suffering and to call on other nations to jump on the wagon and voice their support for Palestine's resistance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A museum in France is hosting treasures of Peru, including the famed Machu Picchu, in a unique experience where technology meets archaeology. Visitors can immerse themselves in a vertical tour of Machu Picchu Citadel and see an exclusive exhibit of Peruvian archaeological objects. The collection is arranged chronologically, passing through the extraordinary diversity of some 13 cultures. The collection displays 200 artifacts spanning 3 millennia, dating as far back as 1500 BC. A large part of the exhibit is dedicated to Peru's Machica civilization with their vase portraits and red ceramics. The museum's curator says the goal was to show that pre-Columbus Peru was far deeper than just the Inca era. Iran's National Museum is displaying a collection of artifacts that was stolen decades ago but has finally returned home after a long legal battle. The items, which include sacred figurines, pots and jars, date back to more than 3,000 years ago. They were stolen and sent to the West more than four decades ago. In 1991, the British Museum was seeking to buy the collection from a smuggler residing in Switzerland. The objects, however, were seized by Swiss police and revealed in court in 2008. Since then, Iran had been trying to get the stolen treasures back home.
Under pressure from the Iranian diplomatic apparatus and the official complaints of the National Museum in 2015, the legal process continued, and finally on December 20, 2020, the collection returned to us.
The collection belongs to the northwestern city of Bukhan, which was the home of Manians around the 10th to 7th centuries BC. The Manians were one of the first nomadic tribes to build cities in that area. The director of Iran's National Museum says the effort to recover other stolen artifacts continues. The country is now holding talks with the U.S. and Australia to return ancient objects smuggled over there.
How long could you work at your job? In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most. Magic returns to Belgium with a purple carpet of bluebells covering the undergrowth of Hallerbos woods near Brussels. Each spring, this beech forest turns into a bluebell spectacular, turning the area into a natural wonderland. Millions of these blooming flowers sprout up across the 550-hectare woods, filling the air with their sweet aroma. The short but enchanting blooming phase offers nature enthusiasts a one-of-a-kind experience.
It is an outstanding and magical place because whenever we come, there's an amazing atmosphere. The sunrise was truly beautiful this morning, and we know this offers the opportunity to take great photos and decorate our house. It is a great comfort during these tough times.
Visitors can stroll the winding paths and watch rabbits and deer wandering through the woods. The forest floor blooms for a period of 7 to 10 days. After this time, leaves begin to grow on the trees above them, blocking the sunlight from reaching the flowers. The phenomenon of bluebell forest is not uncommon in Europe, but the Hallerbos greenery is unique for the density and beauty of its blossoms. A huge pink moon has glowed over Chilean skies, mesmerizing stargazers and ordinary citizens alike. The full moon was completely visible over the capital, Santiago. The celestial phenomenon is called a pink moon as it appears in April and is named after an American plant, pink plot, that blooms in spring. The pink moon will shine during the weekend through early Monday and may be visible in most parts of the world. The phenomenon also marks the calendar for different religious festivities around the globe.
Sunny skies and spring temperatures made for the perfect setting for the 65th birthday of Fatu, the world's oldest gorilla living at Berlin Zoo. At this age, the Western Lowland gorilla is what Berlin Zoo calls almost something of a legend. Gorillas living in the wild have a life expectancy of about 40 years, and at 65, she has been the world's oldest living gorilla for a while. 65 is absolutely extraordinary, and that obviously needs to be celebrated in style.
They mainly get vegetables, and the sugar they receive at most is fruit sugar, and that's what she saw for today in the shape of raspberries and blueberries. They were the decoration on rice cake made of boiled rice, a thin layer of rice and some curd so it sticks together. The bottom was made of a lot of green stuff, then the lion and lettuce.
According to Berlin Zoo, Western Lowland gorillas are now an endangered species after their natural habitat was continuously decimated, and therefore fewer and fewer animals live in the tropical rainforest of Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Gabon, and the Republic of Congo.
Japanese researchers have developed chopsticks that artificially create the taste of salt. They have done this as part of efforts to reduce high levels of sodium intake in Japan. The utensils look like a typical pair of chopsticks, but with a cable and a mini computer worn on the person's wrist. A mild electrical current transmits sodium ions from food through the chopsticks and into the user's mouth. This enhances the taste of salt, requiring less of it in food to achieve the same good taste.
To prevent severe lifestyle-related diseases or to prevent these diseases altogether, we need to reduce the amount of salt we take regularly. Japanese people tend to ingest a large amount of salt in their diet. If we try to avoid taking less salt in a conventional way, we would need to endure cutting out our favorite foods from our diet or endure eating bland food.
The chopsticks have already been clinically tested. Participants say the device enhanced salty taste of low-sodium food by roughly 1.5 times. The engineers are currently refining the chopsticks and hope to commercialize the product next year. The product was jointly developed by Meiji University professor Homei Miyashita and a beverage holding company. Miyashita is best known for his creation of a TV screen that can imitate various flavors.
www.parstoday.com/en